welcome to another great edition of the Tuesday Afternoon Radio Show with your host, Randall Martin. So glad you can join us. And, you know, I often have a lot of great musical guests on my show. And we pride ourselves on bringing you some of the best talent in the region. And we're going to talk to a musical artist who's not only a great musical artist, but a great musical artist from around the world. And she'll actually be performing in Carnegie Hall in New York soon. But before she does that, she'll be performing here in Hudson at the First Presbyterian Church. And I'm talking about Yeva Boot. Yeva, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Hey, tell our audience a little bit about yourself. You know, I read your bio, and you are fascinating and so talented and young to have all of this talent. Give our audience a little bit of your history.
Well, I was born in a tiny town in the south of Ukraine, right on the Black Sea. When I was a kid, I spent a lot of time over there during summer. And when I was like 3.5 years old, I started to play piano. I was walking by a dance school, and I saw like companies playing piano, and I asked my mom like, what instrument is that? And I want to try play that. So my parents got me a small keyboard. We found a piano teacher that could teach me at that young age, because I couldn't go to any like music school because I was too young for that. So I had private lessons. I started like that, and I really liked that. So I started to be more and more involved in that. And at some point, like on more like professional level, and when I was about like 11 years old, I went to one competition where one teacher heard me, invited to boarding school. There were like a couple of boarding schools like that in Ukraine, and I went to the one that is in Kiev, especially for like music. So this was like music boarding school. So at the age of 12, I started my like really like professional music career over there, and since that I didn't stop. And when I graduated, I got to college into United States, just recently graduated, continue doing my music career. I'm teaching a lot, also accompany piano a lot, perform and all kind of things like that.
Wow. I mean, to start so young, it must have been challenging, because, you know, when you're that young, your fingers are small and you can't really, you know, articulate like all the notes. How do you learn when you're so young?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't play like really hard songs at the point. I just did some like small, short songs. Gotcha. And I also didn't know any like letters and things like that at the point. So I was learning notes and like letters and numbers at the same time. So
Wow. It's
kind of fun way to do that.
Wow, that's amazing. What drew you to? Is there something special about music that kind of resonated with you and still does, you know, over other things?
I like that music can kind of like evoke emotions. First, like when I perform, I can evoke emotion from the person. Mm-hmm. And it's like a music therapy. Like it helps to cope with your feelings inside of you, and also help someone else to do that when you play. And the same song can evoke different emotions in different people. Depends like what they're thinking or what they're going through. And this is what I like about music, that it's like emotional like instrument.
Mm-hmm. So when you're playing, does it make you I'm a drummer, and I think a lot of times I play and I feel like I am, you know, you can kind of transport yourself and your mind into like a different world almost, you know, within the song.
Yeah.
Is that sometime, do you feel the same way, and it doesn't happen for you similarly?
Yeah. Of course, when I practice, maybe I don't have this all the time, especially when there's some hard things I can play, have to play over and over again.
Uh-huh.
But like at the final result, when I perform it, just like a whole piece, or perform like on the stage for someone else, I like always try to get very deep into the song and kind of like show what the composer wanted to tell us about this, or like what I want to tell through that song.
When you are, do you have siblings, and is that, does music sort of run in the family?
I don't really have like professional musicians in my family. I know some of my like Craig Rain, like father, he used to play violin, but since that, I was the first one who like started again that music way. I started to play piano, and after that, my younger siblings started to do that. Like almost each of my like siblings or like my dad, they can play some instruments, but just like as a hobby, not as something like professional. But I was the one who decided like to pursue that.
It is so nice when you're young and you know what you want to do, and you kind of find that ladder or that pathway to something that you just innately love and you can do it. Especially something that could be so complex. I mean, when you're playing these pieces that are, you know, scored by these masters, you know, you like you say, you've got to break them down. You got to play them kind of piece by piece by piece and practice them. And then you put it all together. It's quite the feat. Tell me about your competition experience.
So how do I feel like about competitions?
Yeah.
I feel different because some competitions kind of like you already know who's going to win and stuff like that. So you kind of like you prepare yourself that you're going to perform, but you know, like, because there are some juries, they know some other kids. So they go, this is what happened in my like at least experience in life and music competitions.
Really? You feel like they were biased, you know, or from the beginning?
Yeah. My teachers, they always like had the same feeling. They like didn't understand, like they can hear who's like playing a little bit better and stuff like that, and then as a result you see like who won which place, and it's kind of not matching. There are some competitions have like a student jury that don't know anybody, and they had a completely different result. So it's kind of like you can see that it was a little bit biased, yeah. And at that point, I kind of like stopped real liking competitions because you like work so hard, and then as a result, you know, like everybody already knows who's going to win. But it's not like that everywhere. Like there are still like places they try avoid this. They try like your teacher can be a judge or something like that, or like you don't have to know like any judges and things like that. And they're trying to like have this less and less in competitions.
I never realized that. Now, do you think that is it different in Europe and in the US, or do you think it's the same?
I mean, it might be like same, but like on different levels. I can tell for sure. I don't know like all details. I can just, you know, like guess when I'm playing over there, but I don't know for sure. But I feel like it's getting like less and less like this because people trying to add this like new rules to avoid this. But I remember there was some like period of times when I was taking part in competitions a lot, and I could kind of like feel that.
Is it sort of like the Olympics for musicians, or like?
Kind of, yeah. I had like even like a big competition being in that boarding school. We're all musicians over there, and it was hard to be friends with each other because like one day you're friends, next day you have like exam, they give you a grade, or like you go to the same competition, and then you're like, oh, then you have start to have like a tension between you two.
Yeah, how did you ever have like one of your friends win and like you were kind of pissed because you felt like you should have won?
I had backward, I won, and my friend didn't, and I felt bad. Because, like, we had the same teacher, we, like, went to the same competition, and I know that person my whole life, so it was, like, kind of a weird feeling. I felt bad. Like, I know, like, it's not my fault or something, but it just felt weird, like, talking after, like, that ceremony when they, like, gave us awards and stuff.
Really. But when you're playing, I mean, you got to give it your all. So, and it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
You're going to play, yeah. You're just going to play 100%, and what happens, happens.
Yeah. And yeah, you can't really do anything about that. You still like trying, you know, be friends and stuff. And sometimes it can get bad and people really stop talking to you.
Really?
Because like that boarding school was pretty intense. They can expel you. Like every year they expel someone. So you have to have a specific like grade to be there. So they're really like fighting for the grades and stuff. So when the time comes and you have to like play your exam, you forget your friends and stuff like that.
Right. Well, and how old are you at this point?
I mean, I was there since I was like almost 12. So let's say like 12 until 18.
Okay. And you're like kind of the big gal on campus. You know, you're strutting around, winning these things, and you know you've got to, you know, obviously you've got to keep practicing. You want to maintain relationships, but you know they know when they're coming against you in the competition, it's going to be tough for them.
Yeah, especially if you're all like in the same like area, you're going to the same competitions. Mm-hmm. It's yeah.
Well, I'm glad that you persevered. And I know your parents must be very, very proud of you.
Yeah, I think so.
So, all right, you go to boarding school, you get all this talent and molding, and you do these competitions, and then you strike out into the world, into the broader place. And, you know, what did it feel like for you? You won second prize at the just recently, right? The 2024 mm-hmm. annual International Ukrainian Music Competition in New York City. How was that?
I actually never even planned to participate in it. I remember like getting ads about competitions. Guess like when I got into college, I kind of stopped doing competitions. Mm-hmm. I was like busy doing my college, having jobs and stuff like that. So I was not really like thinking that I need to go to competitions. I was too busy and stressed for that. And it was kind of like my last few months of my senior year at college. And then I see this competition like uh-huh. multiple times. And for my senior recital, I prepared like music, Ukrainian music. Uh-huh. So I did have a lot of like Ukrainian repertoire, and then I saw this competition like, wow, it's actually maybe I should get back to competitions and try it again. And I do have a lot of Ukrainian music and can perform. This was like one of the criteria for the competition is to play Ukrainian music.
Uh-huh.
So I found that competition, applied, sent, I think there were like, you had to send a couple of videos. And then it was like a first round. And after a while, they had to like either tell you going to second round or not. So they sent me email that I'm going to the second round and I have to come to New York.
Mm.
But it was the week when I had my senior recital and graduation, so I couldn't make it. And I asked like if there's any virtual ways I can do that. And there were a couple of people who also couldn't come to New York.
Okay.
So we had to do through like Google Meet. What they did, they like put a screen on the stage and we could play and everybody would like listen to us in the audience. Nice. That's kind of an interesting experience. Never
nice.
Done that. And it was just like, yeah, that week was so busy. And then I had to do this like online. I didn't even expect getting any prize or something like that. I was so busy. I was like, okay, I'll do that. I'll try my best, but I don't know how it will go because like it's through Google Meet. I don't know even how it's going to sound like because it's so different when you play like in real life and through like Zoom or stuff like that. Well, apparently it went well. And then, yeah, they sent us like emails with results and stuff like that. And I saw I got a second prize. I was very happy and kind of surprised at the same time because I didn't really like even like pre- kind of like mentally prepare for competition, since there was so many things going on. It was not like the main thing for me, but at the same time, I was like, oh, that's cool.
Well, were you in a way like a little bit more relaxed? You're like, okay, well, you know, I'm going to try my best. But like, you know, instead of the intense focus, when you go on the stage and the glare of the lights there, like you said, you had so many other things going on. Did it feel like just a more natural performance for you? Like you just came and just gave them what was in your heart and got a great result?
Yes, it was like right after I played my senior recital. I knew that piece pretty well. I just kind of, okay, I'll play it once again. And like I would have like prepared it for my recital, so I didn't have like prepare it separately for competition. It was kind of like there already, so it wasn't that stressful for me. But I mean, I still like kind of felt a little bit stressed performing. I know like there are some other people playing, but it was not that like crazy stressful as when I was like younger playing at other competitions.
Are you nervous when you play?
It depends. Like usually I'm not nervous, and like the second I have to go on stage, I'm like, oh no, I start to be like kind of scared. And maybe the first piece I would kind of like be a little bit stress, my leg would shake or something, but then I will be like, okay, everything is fine, I know all the pieces, I'm going to be good. And then I'm kind of okay and start to be like more involved, and it goes pretty smooth.
So now, what do you say to young people that are out there, aspiring musicians, whether it be concert piano or just in band, or you know, or professional competitions? What would you say to them? Because like, you're quite experienced. At a young age, you're really quite experienced at these kinds of sort of high-pressure musical environments. What sort of advice would you give to young people that want to pursue, you know, sort of the higher levels of their instruments?
Maybe I would give them advice to listen like their heart, what they think, even though like maybe some people will tell you you play pretty bad and stuff like that, because I experienced that. I was in this very like competitive environment. People will tell you you're bad just to kind of like make you feel bad.
Oh, okay.
But you have to know you're still good no matter, like, I mean, it doesn't mean you don't have to listen to them. Maybe like they will give you good advice, but still like not give up, even though they tell you like, oh, you play pretty bad, maybe you have to change that, like change your instrument or something like that.
Wow.
Like, give up music,
wow.
You know? You still need to like, I mean, you can go get another opinion from someone else, but still kind of like you can listen to yourself, you can listen to your recording, and you know, like, well, I wasn't that bad, you know, like you still have to be nice to yourself, not to like harsh to yourself, even though like someone tells you you're pretty bad. I had this experience a lot when, you know, my teachers would tell me that like not good enough, you need to do better, and it kind of like makes you feel bad. And at some point you sometimes like you question yourself if you even have to do that, maybe you should give this up. But then you like go to other places and you hear good feedback, and you're like, well, maybe I'm actually not that bad.
So you got to be tough. It sounds like you got to be tough and resilient. You can't just, you know, you have to be able to take criticism, but you know, still be tough.
Yeah, like, I mean, yeah, maybe you did bad, but still like you need to encourage yourself and of course work hard, but not to be harsh on yourself and try to like make yourself feel better. Tell yourself like you're still good, you can do that, and do your best, but not like give up right away if someone tells you that.
So how did you get this strength to sort of believe in yourself despite, you know, despite criticism and despite heavy competition? What in you kind of says, I'm going to keep pressing on, so, you know, and one day I'm going to be the best?
I mean, I was kind of harsh on myself at the beginning. I did, like, listen to them. I did believe I was not good enough. Because you, like, you're in this environment where all the musicians and like they get better grades or they get like higher prizes, and you're like, oh, maybe I'm not good enough, like as other says. But I did hear like support from my family and from maybe other like teachers from other places, and it kind of gave me like a hope that maybe I'm still good. I tried to like listen my recordings and like, oh, actually, like I like how I play this. It's not bad. And I would like visit other like places. For example, like I went to United States, and it's different kind of like culture in music, a different environment. And I would hear their feedback, and it's actually encouraged me a lot. It's less like strict and harsh comparing to like Eastern Europe style of like music education. And I remember like when I got into college here, it actually kind of, you know, like opened my eyes that I'm good, I'm not that bad in playing and stuff like that. This, like, I started to get more positive feedback, and it helped me to grow better in performance and feel more secure when I perform. I remember feeling very insecure when I perform, like, oh, and I'm playing good enough. Like when I do a mistake, I was very stressed about this, but now I feel completely different because like everybody does mistakes, and sometimes nobody even knows in the audience you did a mistake. You just play, you do your best, and you have to be like proud of what you do because you really work hard.
You know, it's amazing to hear you say this because you play so wonderfully and you play so masterfully. Like no one watching you would ever think, oh my God, you know, she made a mistake or she doesn't play perfectly. It is, you know, you play with such force and precision that, you know, from an outsider to hear you, you know, kind of think that anyone would have said that of you, even during your younger years, it just seems kind of unfathomable. But I guess that's just part of the competitive environment.
Yeah. I remember just like I perform and I feel like, oh, I did it very nice. And then I go backstage and my teacher looks at me like just silent, and I like understand, oh, it was bad or something like that. And I don't know if it was doing like they were doing this on purpose just to make you like motivate you like this.
Right, I'm not sure.
But I mean, it did motivate me to like practice more, but in like in a bad way, probably.
Right, but in a way, I mean, in the final analysis, it worked because you're a great pianist.
Yeah, it worked. yeah,
you're pretty great. So, certainly sounds like it was a challenging way to get there.
Yeah, I have like a dream to make the same kind of like boarding school here in the United States, but to make class like competitive environment. I mean, there should be a competition. This is kind of like a thing, a feel like where you do have to have a small competition, but still be like nice.
Right.
Give a positive feedback to your student. Try to like make them feel good, not like bad about themselves.
Right. No, I agree. And you know, and I think you find that in a lot of competitive environments where there are a lot of ways to motivate, and you can motivate under pressure and tell, you know, you're terrible and tell people, you know, bad things about themselves so that they work through it and try to overcome that. Or you can do positive reinforcement. So,
yeah,
you know, I don't know. I don't know which produces the best, which produces the best musician. But in the end, you want a happy, healthy person.
Yes.
So.
And it also depends on the culture. I mean, I feel like if American musicians will be like in Eastern European music education, I'm not sure if they will make it.
Really? And you think it's so harsh that they couldn't survive?
Yeah,
it?
For like maybe for me being born in Ukraine, it's kind of a regular thing, like usual. It doesn't look weird to me. But I know that if someone would, you know, come there for like 1 week in that school, they would feel completely different. It can break them.
Wow.
So, And now I'm like, I teach a lot of like small kids. I know, like, if I would go that way, I was taught they would not be, they would drop music right away.
So that's great. So you're not crushing these kids. You're giving them a little bit of
At
space.
the beginning, I was kind of worried that I was like so into that kind of like system
Right.
that I was scared that I will start kind of teach kids like this.
Right, right.
And because it's kind of like unconscious in my head to be like that, but I was trying my best like not to do that, to
Well,
be
that's
completely
wonderful.
opposite.
Well, that's
I mean, you
wonderful.
still have to like teach, make them like be good, but there are ways to do this without pressure.
Well, I am glad that the pressure didn't get to you in a negative way, and you were able to overcome it and persevere and become the wonderful and very talented pianist that you are. Now, let's talk about your music. I mean, what do you like to play, and what are you going to be playing, you know, both here and in your sort of Northeast tour here?
If I would pick a like period which I would like to play my whole life, it would be probably romantic period.
Okay.
This is the music that really resonates with me because it's like really emotional, like passionate, comparing to like Baroque or classical period when everything is like a little bit less like emotional. It's more like safe and steady, and like in a romantic period it starts to be like extra emotional. And this is what I like in the music. I mean, maybe it's because it's just easier to like play that kind of music when it has more like dramatic changes in it and stuff like that. Yeah, and the music I'm going to play, it's from different periods, mostly probably like romantic and contemporary. I still have something like from classical period, but most of the music is like romantic period. This is what I really like about my program, because it has like a lot of like changes in the music. Maybe like personal to me, I know like there are so many people like classical period or Baroque period. I don't really resonate with it that much. And I remember being in college, my professor like, oh yeah, but you have to play like all other sorts of music, not just romantic period. I'm like, I know, but like I keep like picking this music from that period because I really like it, but I still had to play something else. And it's maybe like a musical taste everybody has different. I can like all the music, of course, and I do have to perform kind of all of it. Well, if I go to competition or I'm auditioning for something, you have to play like all the periods and stuff like that. You have to be professional in all of them because you have to play differently. Like you played Baroque and romantic music, it's completely different style. You need to like adjust your like hand how you play it.
Really? Like, is
And
when you're playing a tight, more precision kind of music versus, like you said, a more wide-ranging music where you're using a lot more of the keyboard back and forth, is it a different? You say you're sort of not your grip. I think about that.
Like Baroque music, it was written for like harpsichord or organ, and nowadays we play on the piano and it's completely different like sound and touch. So you kind of try to like show the harpsichord sound on the piano while you're playing Baroque music. And it's different touch, different articulation, and people work years and years to try like do that. Or classical period, it's also a little bit different from Baroque, different like harmonies, different style and like mood of the piece. And each period has different like style, and that's why you have to play differently to show the difference. That's why when you like audition for something or play for competition, they ask you to play different periods so they can see how good you are in like different styles and how you can make that switch.
Got you. Got you. Now, I've seen you on YouTube play on very large pianos. It looks like a, you know, like a full size, like it looks
Yeah,
larger
like
than a
grand
grand piano.
pianos. Yeah.
Does it make a difference for you, the instrument and the type? Like, do they all have to be Steinways? And is it a difference between playing a baby grand and a full grand?
Yeah, there are differences. Grand piano has like bigger range. It's louder. Uh-huh. You can play louder in it comparing to upright pianos. Same as like digital piano, like digital keyboard. It's also completely different world. Uh-huh. Some of them, like maybe very like expensive keyboards, they try to make them super similar to actual piano, and you don't really feel the difference. But the thing that I don't like about digital pianos, that when you touch a key, it doesn't touch a real string. So gotcha. It's like, it's different feeling when you do that. It feels more like artificial comparing to actual piano. You can, like when you play, you can feel the strings, like,
so you can feel the vibration
like inside. Yeah. Yeah. And you can like adjust your sound more like easier on the real piano than the electronic piano.
Huh. Now you're living here now, right?
I mean, I live in the United States, but yeah. You mean like the state?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm right now in Colorado.
Do you think about, with all the political things that are happening and war and stuff, does it make you, and you're playing one of your Ukrainian pieces, does that influence kind of the dynamics of how you play, because what you're thinking about as you're playing?
Yes, it does. There are some pieces that are, like, you can feel like sadness in it, some mm-hmm. like dark color mm-hmm. in it. And there are some pieces when I perform, I really like feel that, and I kind of try like to show that,
okay,
to evoke this like emotion of the piece. And I see this like pictures in my head of this like war when I performed that. And when I played my senior recital, at the very end, I play Elegy by Mykola Lesenka, and okay. I dedicate it to all the soldiers who put their lives for Ukrainian freedom. And like, this piece was written so many years ago, but Elegy, this genre, is like more like a memorial genre. When like someone dies, you would like play this kind of music. Mm-hmm. So when I played this piece for so many years, even like before the war started, and when it like I had to play it at the concert and I played this piece, I was like, oh, I see it from different side right now. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel it differently, because like when I played it when I was like 15, I might thoughts about something else when I played it. But right now, it evokes like other emotions in me, other meanings in me. Mm-hmm. So anytime I play this piece, I kind of think of all those people who died, and like how like sad and bad it is.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. How do you want people to feel when they, you know, what do you want people to take away from your performance? Like when you come here, and is your show, obviously you're going to play different songs between here and Carnegie Hall, or are they the same songs?
I'm going to play one of the pieces from my program. Yeah, it's going to be same Carnegie Hall. First, I want people to hear like Ukrainian music, since not much people can get access to it. It's not like mm-hmm. everywhere. This is what I'm trying to do with this program, to like make it more popular. And it is like really great music. I remember showing to my professor. She's like, oh, I never heard it, but it's like so cool and great. It's not like worse than like other famous composers like Mozart or like Beethoven. Uh-huh. And such composers, like, there are still also great composers and musicians in Ukraine that not much people were able to hear or play. So I'm kind of trying to like take it back to life and show to people.
Very nice.
And I want just to feel kind of like a culture and Ukrainian soul in this music, because all these pieces, they have a lot of like folk melodies you can hear. Mm-hmm. And I know that every person will probably feel like different emotions about the piece and different maybe like stories in their heads, depends what they're like going through or what they're thinking of. It's not like I'm trying to show specific emotion. I want everybody to feel it like that. I perform it like I feel, but I know someone else will feel it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And my goal is not like to make them feel like I feel, but just like enjoy the music, get something from it, get some maybe therapy. Because music is a very, very good tool for like healing the soul.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And when you're done with your music and a concert, especially one that's very meaningful with you, do you have sort of a thing that you do, you know, like because you're gonna do a lot of also speaking to the audience and giving them a sense of kind of not just the context of some mm-hmm. of the music. Is there like sort of it's like a routine, a thing that you do at the end of a show?
What exactly do you mean? Like what I like to tell the audience of the concert?
Yeah. At the end of a performance, that's sort of your sort of signature thing.
Usually at the end, I try to put like the piece that means like the most to me that I uh-huh. really love. Or like with this, at this specific program, I put Elegy at the very end. It's like kind of, it's a very slow piece and like very sad. It's kind of like a moment to stop and think
mm-hmm.
of what is going on in the world and with everything. I know like some musicians, they put a piece that is like really quick and like cool and you feel like, oh, that musician was so great. And I do have those like pieces at the very end, but the very, very last one, I put like Elegy just to like after all of what I played, I want the person just to like stop and think
mm-hmm.
and feel like kind of come back to reality or something like this. And it just kind of like you play this and you need to sit like in the silence for a bit to just like gather all of your thoughts and things like that.
Very, very nice. Well, I can't wait to see you perform here. I know, and it's a wonderful place where you're going to be performing because the sound and the acoustics are so great there. And I think you're going to love it as a venue, and I know that the audience is going to love to hear you. Now, before we go, your name is interesting, and in the beginning, because I asked you like, what's the best way to pronounce it, and your full name is, go ahead.
Evangelina. I think like it's like Evangelina, more probably okay. American way to say it. Yeah.
But your last name is Boot. But mm-hmm. the spelling, that's not the spelling that we see.
Yeah, the spelling is kind of weird.
Yeah, so can you explain that?
So, I can tell a short story like why I was named Evangelina. My dad, he is a priest, and when he was in Bible college, they uh-huh. were learning some like stories about one female general, Evangelina Boot.
Uh-huh.
She was in a Salvation Army, and when he heard about her, he was like, "Oh, when I will have a daughter, I'll call her like that because like they have the same last names." So he like, oh, my daughter is going to be Evangelina. So when I was born, they called me name after her. And when you do documents in Ukraine, they have to translate to like English. And I don't know, maybe there are some rules how they translate, do transcript and stuff like that. So they spell it as B-U-T. And it sounds like but, not like as a boot. Usually,
right.
And I know people with the same last name. Their spelling in the passport is B O O T H, and it makes more sins. Right, and this right. is how that Evangelina Booth, she has B-O-O-T-H in English. So I kind of struggle with this a lot in college or when I perform somewhere or like someone calls me, because it spells differently when you see it.
Right. So when you hear that, it doesn't sound like they're talking to you.
Oh, I mean, I'm kind of used to that. I know what I mean. I more struggle with name when I have to spell it on the phone and there's so many letters.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's a beautiful name and it's going to be a wonderful program. And we're so excited that you're going to be here. And this is January 4th.
Yes.
At the First Presbyterian Church at 7 p.m. And it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful program. Any thoughts before we close out? And I'm going to close out with a song. You tell me what song you want me to play, and I'll play it in the conclusion of my interview.
Okay, let me think. I really like the piece. It calls Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber.
Okay.
It's a... is the piece you just need to like listen kind of like in silence, just take a moment. It's very like slow and kind of sad, but this is what like emotional state I have right now, like about the war and everything. And this is like a piece of real love to listen to.
Well, wonderful. We're going to exit with that and play a bit of that. So nice to talk to you and have you on the show, and look forward to seeing you on January 4th. That's Yeva Boot, and she's going to be here right in our own backyard at the First Presbyterian Church. Thank you so much for visiting with us, and we will see you on the 4th.
Sure, yeah, I had a really good time talking to you. Thank you.
My pleasure. And we're going to take this tune, and we'll be right back on the Tuesday Afternoon Radio Show with your host, Randall Martin. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you.
Fisher, and Sergei Rachmaninoff, Elgin.
Thank you.
welcome to the Tuesday Afternoon Radio Show with your host, Randall Martin. So glad you can join us again in the 5 o'clock hour. You know, it's important now that we're going to start a new year to kind of look back and look at our old year. And we're going to do so in Hudson. And we're going to talk to the mayor of Hudson. And he's going to tell us all about what the old year was like, what the government was able to accomplish, and all the great things that are happening here in the city. So we have here Mayor Kamal Johnson. How are you?
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be on.
Hey, man, it's a pleasure. It is a pleasure. Hey, so let's talk about you. This is going to be your what term? Is it third term?
Third term, yeah. It's my third term.
How do you feel about it?
5 years, yeah. I mean, I feel like...
It went by quick.
It went by super fast. I mean, 3 of those years was COVID. So, you know, I was like thrown right into the fire and, you know, right to work. I feel like, you know, a veteran now. Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, I have a grasp on things. We got a lot accomplished in the past 5 years. And, you know, there's still so much to do. But I definitely feel like a different candidate than when I first announced that I was running, and they were like, you know, he doesn't have the experience, he's green, and you know, all of these things that they were saying about me at the time, he's too young. I think, you know, me and my team have lived up to the expectations, you know, that we set, and we've done things that we're very proud of.
Well, you definitely proved them wrong. And let's talk about COVID. I mean, you really held the city together.
Mm-hmm.
And did so many things to help people during this desperate, unforeseen time in the nation. And I think that there was a sense of calm in the city. I know we were able to get, you guys did mask handouts. There were cleaning supplies handouts. There were all sorts of things that the city did in order to confront this. And really, that's something to be proud of, because I think that we weathered the storm. And especially, you know, we have a housing authority, and we were able to get them in a situation where actually there was very few, if any, COVID reports in the building, let's say, because mm-hmm. of the building and people being so close together.
Which was a huge win. You know, Hudson, we really rallied together as a community during COVID. A lot of people don't know, we gave out hotspots to students That's who right. needed internet. And I hand-delivered a lot of those myself, because we didn't have, you know, the staff, and everybody was taking all these precautions. So, you know, I was actually out there delivering door-to-door to students. I had a whole list, me and the school district, of where to go. And, you know, it was just great to see the community come together and, you know, want to provide for each other. And that's what it's all about, you know. And we're still here today, you know, stronger than ever. You know, when people thought, you know, the city would just be crumbling mm-hmm. under all the pressure and everything that's happening. But, you know, it's a thriving city, and, you know, there's still more to do, more to accomplish, and more things that, you know, we're excited about.
Well, you were really out front with the students, because even at a time when most people didn't realize the tremendous adaptation that kids had to do, you know, kids now had to learn from home. And if you didn't have proper internet, mm-hmm. you were totally out of your educational situation. So you, by your administration being able to facilitate that very basic high-speed communication to them, that really, mm-hmm. I think, helped save a lot of students' career, keeping them from falling further behind. And again, to be commended. Are there lessons that you learned in that situation that you look back and you reflect upon?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that, you know, being able to adapt to change at a quick rate and adapt to emergencies fast was a lesson that, mm-hmm. you know, I had to learn on the go. A lot of that, even though we were able to get supplies and internet and different things to the community, it didn't stop there. So I held like these SOC challenges against one of the assistant principals at the middle school. Mm-hmm. And before and after each of those challenges, we would give out vital information while we had the full attention of students and families.
Right.
And it was a huge thread of communication that people were getting that they normally wouldn't have. So we had to find ways to be creative during that process. And it helped me get to know families and community members, teachers, everyone at a time where we were all, you know, supposed to not be in contact with each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of being creative, I remember the great Sock Off.
Yeah.
I think it really inspired students by being able mm-hmm. to come out and, you know, and you with Brian McCormick and talk yeah. about
Ian McCormick.
I'm sorry, Ian. All right, I get the McCormicks confused. Ian McCormick. And you guys were really inspiring to the students. They seen the mayor kind of styling mm-hmm. and in a sort of in an informal way, but able mm-hmm. to really encourage them to participate, to stay engaged in school. And that was a remarkable thing. And again, you didn't have to do it. But it was just
it was a lot of fun too.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of those things that if you're gonna do this job and you're gonna mm-hmm. be, you know, face of a community, then you know you have to be the face of the whole community. You gotta come out your comfort zones. You gotta meet people where they're at, and you know that was one of those situations. Like people that actually know me know that I'm a very shy person. I'm a very quiet and shy person, but. Being the mayor in the face of the community, I have to be out there and I have to interact with people. And, it just, when there's ways to be creative and fun and outside of the box thinking, it makes it so much easier.
Well, you know, that is one of the things about you that I think that maybe not people realize that you are shy. Mm-hmm. I'm not you, but you know, you do, you know, but that doesn't affect your effectiveness. You're always out doing something and mm-hmm. promoting something and getting things done, getting things passed, getting initiatives to happen. And even against your sort of inner nature, maybe to not be so visible doing it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. And we've been able to accomplish, you know, so much, especially in, you know, housing and mental health. And these are all things that are very personal to me and personal to, you know, the community. Where I felt like previous leaders kind of ignored or didn't see, mm-hmm. you know, the value in really going after initiatives that can tackle some of these issues.
Now, a lot of things that you did, especially in housing, I think people didn't realize was a long process, a big vision, long process things. And a lot of times people, if they don't see things immediately, like what's going on, what's happening. But, you know, when you're talking about $50 million projects, $100 million projects, these are big, expensive price tag, and they take a long time to happen. But here we see, and we're going to talk about specifically things in this year, where people, where people are seeing those programs really happen and you know mm-hmm. it's being built, you know, buildings going up and things happening. That's tremendous. Let's talk about, you know, some of those things that people are now being able to see that literally took, you know, years and years to develop.
One of the most visible is Depot district, which is, you know, about I would say 65% completed. We actually started that project in 2019. That was when I first announced that project would be going underway. So it took, you know, till now to fully get it fully funded, get all the right, parameters under it and everything. So these things take time, unfortunately. Government moves really slow, but, having a team that's going to continue to push and be creative while we get new housing built, helps a lot. We're not satisfied just by, you know, having a couple of projects in the pipeline. We understand that the housing crisis is happening right now. Mm-hmm. And, we want to make sure we affect the people that it's happening to, you know, at the moment, as well as, you know, families and people who want to be here in the future.
Absolutely. And the only way that that's going to happen is if affordable housing is made available. And, you know, here, mm-hmm. Hudson, Kingston, Albany, all of these communities, local,
They build housing.
Yeah, exactly. And they're prioritizing housing. And, you know, I think you've been very effective at it. But again, it takes time to do it. And I think that in the projected projects that are either being built or on the slate to be built, we're talking about a couple hundred, maybe 250 new housing.
Yeah, units. About 260 units of affordable housing, you know, over the next 3 years.
Which was exactly what your comprehensive plan, it wasn't your plan. It was,
I
was on that committee, but it was
the city's plan.
It was the city's plan that concluded that that's what we needed. So you're kind of right on target with that.
Yeah, and we've been following every study. Like, everything that we've been doing has a process to it. It also has, you know, evaluators in the state and the governor and all these people that are involved that are monitoring everything to make sure that, you know, our plan is going right. You know, one of the things that's interesting is if you talk about housing in any of the other cities, the capital region, and any of these places, they credit Hudson. They give us credit for, you know, being ahead of the curve on a lot of our initiatives and our projects. So I'm proud, especially this is a very small community. So to, you know, always get a shout out from the bigger cities is, you know, something that, you know, speaks highly to the work that we've been able to do.
So now I know that some people in town, your critics, will say, you know, hey, you know, we can't afford these new residents, these projects. What would you say to that?
I would say the new projects are a lot cheaper than the current market that's here. So whatever market rate housing that's online that you can find by some chance, any of these projects is cheaper than that housing. Not to mention, the hope is that with more housing, it will create competition to bring prices down as well. Because right now, you have no options. So
right.
If you're going to pay,
$2,000
$3,000 right. for a two-bedroom with nothing included, you're going to have to pay it or you're going to have to move.
Right.
There's no other options.
Right. And, you know, I think it's, you know, the character of Hudson. I was talking to somebody the other day, and I was reminding them, you know, I am originally from New York, but the character of Hudson is so special. And a lot of it has to do with its diversity. And it sets Hudson apart from many of those other communities on the river. I think people come, it's got a city, country feel that really, you know, it has a lot to do with our diversity of population. And that's, you know, largely in jeopardy, especially when, you know, apartments are, you know, hugely expensive, like rents that you would expect in huge urban areas. So by having available apartments, workforce apartments, available apartments that will cater along the spectrum, you're really helping to keep the character and the neighborhoods of Hudson still viable and vital.
Yeah, the soul of Hudson. You know, I want to be able to drive around Hudson and see kids playing and see, you know, vibrant life, not just tourism. Not that there's anything wrong with tourism, but I want to actually see life here, things happening. That's why Hudson became popular, is because of its diversity, you know, the arts, the architecture, all of these things. Right. Like, people wanted to be around that. And, you know, in previous interviews, I've talked about how the Black population has dropped 50%, how right now the census says that there's only 713 Black individuals living in the city of Hudson. You know, we have to protect that population. We have to build more housing. We have to, you know, have more opportunities for people to live here. We have to advance our workforce. There's a lot of work that, you know, has to be done if we want to protect our main resource, which is the people.
Now, I know that, you know, tourism is a big part of the city, but you also have helped a lot of business development. And personally, I feel like, you know, we can stabilize rents. You know, you can help mm-hmm. people stay in their apartments, but ultimately we got to build jobs. We got to have jobs yeah. for people to have. And you've been a big mm-hmm. part of that. There have been where the old food plant was, the name escapes me. What's that plant down there?
Pocketbook Factory.
Yes, we have the Pocketbook Factory. We mm-hmm. have new hotels coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the place, the right down on, I want to say Depot Street, all the way down there where the food place was. There's a whole new food operations down there that's...
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't know, but I can see it. I can see it in my mind's eye.
I'm trying to be with you in the vision here.
but they're doing a huge, they have a huge project happening down there, mm-hmm. some employing people. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about building jobs where Hudson is making things.
Yeah, we've been pushing employment. We've been on the front lines with the healthcare workers. Hudson's largest employer is the hospital.
Yes.
We've been pushing for fair contracts for them. Right now they have over 250 positions open. So we're working hard to save and protect the workers that are there and to make sure that all of our medical services stay here in Hudson. We also, you know, started out my tenure giving out grants to Black and women owned businesses, which was like huge, you know, had never been done at the city level before. And, you know, we're just going to continue to promote and to push. A lot of people don't know my 40 under 40 events that we've had in previous years. Those highlighted a lot of business owners and young entrepreneurs that really put them in the spotlight. And people started reaching out to me because another high employer are the not-for-profits, even though, you know, some people tend to discredit the not-for-profits in the community. They're a high employer of people in a community. And a lot of people reached out to those individuals that were part of the 40 under 40 in the 2-3 years that it was done and added them to their boards and added them to their workforce. And it was really that type of out of the box thinking mm-hmm. of where people said, there's no young people here. And I said, no, there's plenty of young, successful people here. Let me show you and bring them out into the forefront and let them be a part of the community.
Excellent. Excellent. I mean, I think that's that well-rounded approach is what helps communities, you know, thrive. And because remember, I mean, obviously you have this generation or the, you know, present population, but you also are dealing with what the future generation is going to be able to do and what that's going to look like. And so investing in the youth, which is a big thing for you. I know that, you know, the youth and education is really one of the core things that you work towards solidifying.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's dive into that a little bit, because that's part of that is really your background.
Yeah. You know, I started in youth work, you know, so the youth are very important to me. You know, I made sure that we have a fully funded youth center mm-hmm. and, you know, activities that our kids can and parents can be proud of, a place that's safe, a place that, you know, you can bring your kid and don't have to worry about anything. And then we've done a lot of partnering with the school. You know, right now I'm sitting on the committee to try to curb chronic absenteeism. And, you know, we're coming up with creative ways to get to families and to make sure that kids get to school, because when a child misses, you know, even one day of school, it's like, you know, they've missed weeks. And since COVID, you know, learning and these kids at this point have very taken a hit on their education. So we're coming up with ways, and we're going to continue to work with all parts, you know, of the community. I know our school district is often, you know, the topic of, you know, discussion, and we're going to continue to work with them and make sure that all of our kids get out of there and get on to 4-year schools or to, you know, employment or whatever they, you know, they want to do.
Now, when you think about the future of Hudson, and and all the things that have happened, what do you see when you really look at it? And I also want to mention too that before you answer that, I just want to, but it popped into my mind about what you were able to do that was very unique in this city with and for business. Before we get off that topic, with the sort of closing Warren Street and the extension of the cafes where people could be outside. That started during the COVID period, continued and really helped businesses to be able to sustain themselves and stay.
Yeah, the Shared Streets Initiative. I took a lot of hits for that, but, you know, we did that, you know, to help businesses out. I think it was, you know, very successful.
Yeah.
I think it was a little frustrating to residents, but I'm glad at the end of the day that we did it and that businesses got to see some success at a time where we saw a lot of businesses across the nation closing.
Yes, yes. And, you know, making the city walkable, making the city sustainable, walkable, a lot of that stuff we see, it's talked about in the new comprehensive plan, and it's sort of the new style that cities are molding themselves in to have people, you know, have these communal areas and these main streets be really much more vital, much more revitalized by having those open areas where people can walk and shop and eat and all this other stuff. So it is emblematic of a trend that's happening nationwide.
And that's what we want. We want to beautify our city. We want it walkable. We want it affordable. You know, we want to renew all of our parks. You know, every park in Hudson is under some sort of revitalization or has a plan for revitalization to make this more family friendly, beautiful environment. You know, our sidewalks are currently under construction, and these are things that have been ignored for so long. So when I came in, you know, people are like, oh, the infrastructure is crumbling, or this and that is happening. And, you know, even there's like some criticism of me with that. And I'm like, the last comprehensive plan that we had was in 2002. I was in 11th grade. so it's like all of this didn't start happening when I got here. You know, this has been happening, and I'm, you know, I happen to be at the one that's at the helm when it's all coming to head and needs to be fixed and there needs to be plans put in place. So, you know, here I am, year five, making those plans and getting it done.
I got to tell you, I mean, one of my pet picadillos was on the street here on Union Street was the steps that headed head down. And they, for a long time, many years, they were in total disrepair. Well, lo and behold, I passed by and they're all fixed up and nice, and, you know, and it's just, it's wonderful. And the bridge, you know, that leads over to finally, it is, you know.
Yeah.
And
we're
that was
excited
amazing.
About the bridge.
Yes, that's exciting. I watched them put, you know, some of those big iron steel girders and things. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what they're doing, and it's going to be fantastic. And I think your administration can definitely, it happened during your watch. You took credit, you made it happen.
Yeah. No, we made sure that got done. I mean, that and, you know, the other initiatives. Stuff like our wellness hub, like we wanted to do the broader things, but at the same time handle the issues that local people care about.
Right,
so we're going
to
deal with mental health and all of those things like homelessness, but we're also going to fix the bridge. We're also going to, you know, help with transportation. Like we're not going to leave any stone unturned.
Well, that's what good government does. You know, I believe you make a balance of different priorities, but, you know, in the end, you produce tangible results, not just ideas for people, but tangible results. Now, you talked about mental health and services for our some of our unhomed people, and you've got a great solution. You have a warming center, which is critical. It was 6 degrees, and people were literally not having that resources. We would have had fatalities on the street had it not been for your homing your warming center. Let's talk about that.
The mission on Green Street, you know, they worked really hard to get that underway. I was, you know, honored to be an early part of that. They came to me when they first had the idea. And, you know, it's off the ground now. There's a lot of services, you know, that are being provided to those who are unhoused. And, you know, like you said, it's been the last few nights have been freezing temperatures. And knowing that people have somewhere to go that's warm, that's going to have a hot meal, that's going to be safe, is important. We needed that desperately. So I'm so thankful to, you know, all the people that helped put that together. Bob Gibson from the county deserves, you know, a ton of credit, you know, as well as the folks who founded it. And then we have our wellness hub that, you know, we're partnering with the Greenberger Center and the county and mental health and everyone that's going to provide a homeless shelter that's going to be fully 30 beds, that's going to have medical and mental health services on site. And that's going to have all of these things that our county is really missing.
So now, you know, when you look at all of those things, I mean, what makes you or helps you to become such a connector? Because you work very well with the county and you work very well with all the agencies to sort of help bridge those gaps where you know, the city is talking to the county and things are getting done and you can see it on the street. What is it about your approach that you think helps you make those sort of well-meaning ideas into tangible products and projects that actually get done and get funded?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's having a purpose behind it. And, you know, everything that I work on, I care personally about. You know, I've been homeless before. You know, I've have family members that have been justice impacted before. You know, I've had family members that have battled addiction and all these things in my life. So I'm not so far removed from the issues that are plaguing our city, you know, currently. So I'm right on the ground where either I see them affect me personally or I talk to people that are, you know, it's happening to or that are doing the work. And that, I think, transitions into, you know, people wanting to work with me because they know that I don't want to just do a report and have it sit on the shelf. Like, no, I want to do something that we're going to help people. And, you know, that's all I care about. I didn't get into this. I didn't run for, you know, to have a title. You know, I was already doing a lot of the work that I'm doing now, even before I became mayor. This just gave me the point to do it at a higher level. But, you know, I think that's what draws so much of the partnerships. And it's also, you know, I can't do this alone. This is not, you know, something one person can do.
Well, you know, you're right. Your whole administration, I think, is wonderful, accessible. I mean, you know, you can come and visit and
yeah, we're everywhere. You come right in the office.
Exactly.
You tag me. I'll pull up on community boards. I don't hide. I'm here.
This is very, very true, and I think it's very important. And you know, you can see again the results of what you do, and again, it's being noticed. I know the city can't take total credit, or even maybe most of the credit, but we were instrumental in helping move the Clean Slate agenda along as being one of the early adopters that. And then obviously that became law, and some of the major movers like Lukey Forbes and Tanya Jackson, all they were able to really take, again, a great concept and really turn it into state law. I mean, and obviously there are many people involved in that process. But I think the city does deserve some credit, as well as what just happened with the landlord. Good cause legislation. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. I think, you know, there was a lot of misinformation when Good Cause was first being presented, which, you know, often happens when there's legislation. There's a lot of like fear and that there's a lot of if this happens, then this will happen. But, you know, we looked at the data, we spoke to other cities that implemented this, and we've been actually a part of this legislation for about 5-6 years. So finally it was able to, you know, come off and the council was able to approve it, and I was able to sign and adopt it, which, you know, we're happy about. We want to protect renters here. We also want to protect property owners. We want to make sure people are not being taken advantage of.
Right.
People are still being able to be evicted if you're not paying, or if you're destroying property, or if you're, you know, breaking, you know, any type of commitments in your lease. But what we want to do is stop the unfair and unjust evictions.
Well, again, wonderful, and that you're looking at this not only from a local problem, but you look at what other cities are doing, you look at what's effective, you have the data, and then you can really respond appropriately to our city and look at what's a proper path for our city. And now we've had a wide-ranging conversation. I just wanted to do the year in review, but really, I think you got to look at everything in context, because again, a lot of things that government do, as you say, move slowly. So something might come to fruition. So what would you like to see? What things that you're proposing now that you'd like to see come through and happen?
Yeah, so we have, you know, two housing projects that are in the pipeline. We should hear about funding for the one on Mill Street soon. I would love to see those come to fruition. Our wellness hub is coming along. I think that's going to be a huge addition to the county. We're working with some folks who are rehabbing Dunn Warehouse. There's a possibility of a community pool there. There's also going to be, you know, different services down there, entertainment space, places where you can sit down and eat. They'll serve food and drinks and different things like that. So it's really going to bring some life down to our waterfront. And at the same time, you know, I'm looking to plan for the future. All of our parks being revitalized, our comprehensive plan really telling us, you know, where we should be in the next 10 years and creating a roadmap that says, you know, this is how you get there. And this is, you know, how the city is checking off and marking its accomplishments on getting and accomplishing everything on that comp plan. You know, I think that we've done a lot, but there's still, you know, so much to do. I like the shape that, you know, we're in. And we have so much that still we didn't get to announce. You know, we just got a grant last week for home repairs. So we're going to be announcing that soon. So this is one of the first places that, you know, get to hear it. But we got, you know, about $500,000 to help
for local homeowners to affect
repairs.
Yes,
for local homeowners. Yes. And then we got another $120,000 to help, you know, make it accessible for people with handicap issues and need to make their home more handicap accessible. So this is actually, you know, our second round of these. We did this a year ago where we took on 8 homes and we revitalized them here locally in the city of Hudson. People that, you know, really needed help getting over that hump and, you know, needed repairs and different things done to their home, a new roof or, you know, windows, insulation, you know, you name it. We've been able to do it. So it's not, you know, just that we're affecting renters, but we're also helping property owners as well.
Very nice. You know, you're I think that you have a vision and that you know, and there's an approach that comes from the top and you make it happen. But also, you also have a lot of bottom-up information and integration into what you do. So it's not just, or not even a majority top-down. You take a lot of pain to get information and community input, like with this, like with this revitalization plan. You take a lot of time to get what the people want and what they're thinking about, and then integrate that into your plan. Talk about your sort of accessibility that the city has, so that people can voice their opinion, have their concerns heard, and really feel part of how things are moving forward.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that the first methods that we put out was the community survey. So that was sent, you know, to a mass amount of people, everybody, you know, who could assess it. And we wanted to get feedback that way. We got a lot of feedback, but we know that, you know, a lot of people don't want to come in a survey, don't want to fill out a survey. So we had also focus groups. We had focus groups based on the populations that had least filled out the survey, and we sat down with those populations and got all of their input and everything so that we added more data. Then we went to the school district and we talked to the students and we said, you know, what do you guys think? Then we went to the youth center and we talked to the younger students and we wanted to know what you think. And we talked to teachers and, you know, medical people, and we wanted information from everybody. And like, what made it key is that we met them on their own terms. We went to their places. You know, we didn't say come here to City Hall or come to this event. We had those events where mass people can show up, but also right. we took the opportunities to go to churches, go to mosques, go to these places and get information as well.
What do you want Hudson to be known for? Hudson's known as the friendly city way back, and I think it's still a pretty fairly friendly city. What yeah. would you like for your administration Hudson to be known for?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a hard question. I just want it to be known, and I want it to be inhabitable by people that want to live, that want to be in this community and raise families in this community and be a vital part of this community. All of the, you know, articles and coolest city, the friendliest city, the, you know, whatever, like that doesn't mean anything to me. I want to make sure that I see familiar faces when I walk the streets, that, you know, I feel like it's home.
Well, I think that's a perfect summation. Anything else you want to say before we wrap up this year in review?
No. I'm just happy to, you know, be at this point and, you know, working for the city of Hudson, and, you know, we still got, you know, a lot to do. I'm looking forward to, you know, the elections and everything that next year brings, any type of reforms and all of that stuff. You know, I'm looking forward to all of it.
Well, you know what? You actually brought up another topic that I wanted to touch. there's been some question about management styles, and people say, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't have a mayor anymore. Which, you know, mm-hmm. despite all the great things that you've done, seems weird, but they say that. But mm-hmm. also they said city managers can do a more effective job at managing a city. But mm-hmm. that person's not elected. That person's not accountable. Let's talk about that a little bit from your perspective.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't have an issue with the city manager kind of format. I think that it's not the right fit for Hudson. I saw how a city like Yonkers transferred into it and then went back to a mayor system. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just think we're at a point where you really have to listen to the people. And the people right now, you know, they elected me. They came out mm-hmm. in numbers. And, you know, they asked for me to speak for the city. And I have been. Going forward, I'm not going to always be at this role. So one of the reasons that I got involved with this is because I wanted to make sure that whoever is in this role is speaking directly for the community mm-hmm. and has a passion for the community. When you have a position like a city manager, they're pulled away from the community. They're not a direct person. They're more looking on the business side of, you know, the community, which right now Hudson needs someone to focus on the soul of the community. They need, if you look at something like Winter Walk, mm-hmm. Winter Walk was canceled originally, and the community was in, you know, so much pain, so much frustration and anger, where they felt like one thing after another is being removed from the city of Hudson. Me, as a mayor who's like for the people and, you know, is not afraid to interact with the people, I said, look, I'm from this community. I live in this community. Like, we have to do something about this. We have to take this personal, and we have to figure out a way to get this back on. And that's the difference between, right. you know, someone who is just here on the business side and someone who's here, you know, and giving their heart to the job. You know, who can also do the business.
Right,
you know what
right,
I mean?
Right, right.
Who can also do the business. I can also say that, you know, 4 out of the 5, you know, budgets that I've done, we haven't raised taxes. You know, we've kept taxes flat. You know, we've done all the things that they're saying a city manager can do. We're already managing.
Right, right. And I have to say that by all accounts, this past Winter Walk that came together really under your leadership was one of the best ever, from what I hear.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was amazing. I was blown away. And I'm thankful to the Foundry and everybody who stepped up and partnered with us on that. And it was an amazing experience. And I think one of the things that makes Hudson a hotbed in the political spectrum is the fact that our local elections mean so much. Mm-hmm. So to take, you know, the mayor out of that conversation and also, you know, minimize the number of council members, you're minimizing the voices that are speaking for the community. So right. Now, instead of having, you know, 11 members, you only have 5 members, when it's tough to get, you know, people in the room in these meetings. There's like, you know, oftentimes you serve on boards, you know, sometimes we don't even have a quorum. So to ask, you know, one person to speak for an entire ward and to be accountable to that ward is tough. It's very tough. And, you know, we are a city that traditionally is so used to being able to call upon its leaders when there's an issue,
right,
or, you know, whatever. So to not have that, you know, factor to be able to call upon, you know, the leaders when there's an issue, it's going to create a lot of distrust.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I agree. And one last thing, I know I've said that before, but also Hudson's a clean city and a safe city. And I think that people don't really appreciate those elements because it's just kind of just there and people don't appreciate it. But you want to speak to that a little bit before we go?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've done wonders with this police force. You know, they're younger. We have our first woman of color who's in charge, Chief Mashonda Franklin. We also have Judge Cheryl Roberts over at the city court who, you know, we've created a city mental health court, which is only the second one in our judicial district. And there's more announcements that are going to be coming at the start of the year about that as well that I'm excited about. But like these changes and putting people in positions who really care and want to make change, you know, they've made us look at everything that we're doing a different way. And like on the national level, we've been, you know, cited for our mental health courts, our universal basic income initiatives, you know, all of these things. We were on the forefront of police reform. You know, we were the ones that stepped out of there before, you know, former Governor Cuomo said everyone needs to do that. We were the ones that we already had our plan done at that point. And if you look at back in 2020, 2021, when there was so much civil unrest, I held a rally at a time where people were tearing their communities up and people were saying like, no, don't hold this rally. And we brought hundreds of people out and I asked people, I said, this is not a curfew. This is me, you know, as your mayor and someone who cares about our community saying, you know, after this, everybody go home. Let's have a quiet night, you know, at 7 p.m., 8 p.m. Let's have these streets vacant. And everybody felt it. And everybody, the streets were clear. Everybody came together. They felt heard. They felt like our community was doing something to stand up to a lot of the, you know, disrespect that was happening to marginalized communities. And, you know, we stood stronger after that.
Absolutely.
And you don't get that with a city manager.
That's true. You know, I think, you know, if you look at the time period that you served and continue to serve, you know, it comes from crisis to conquering a lot of these issues. And I think that again, your administration deserves a lot of credit. And in that transition, I think people would agree that Hudson is a great place to live. People are coming from all over the world to do that. But also securing the issues of locals is also an important criteria for what you do And I think it's working. I think people are responding. And I thank you, you know, for what you've done. And that is,
you're very welcome.
I appreciate it. And I think that, you know, that's a fitting way for us to wrap up this year in review in Hudson with the mayor, Mayor Kamal Johnson. And we're going to take a tune, and that's going to do it for this Tuesday afternoon radio show with your host, Randy Martin. And we will see you next time. Have a happy and safe new year.
Listen, baby, ain't no mountain high, ain't no valley low, ain't no river wide enough, baby.
If you need me, call me, no matter where you are, no matter how far.
Don't worry, baby,
just call my name, I'll be there in a hurry. You don't have to worry, cause baby, there ain't no mountain high enough. Thank you.